13. Saudi Arabia's religious fifth column. You don't understand, you don't want to understand, that a reverse crusade is underway. A war of religion they call holy war, jihad. You don't understand, you don't want to understand, that for those reverse crusaders the West is a world to conquer and subjugate to Islam. Politically correct, you don't realize or don't want to realize that a war of religion is being carried out. A war they call jihad. A war that does not aim at the conquest of our territory, maybe, but certainly aims at the conquest of our souls and the disappearance of our freedom. A war which is conducted to destroy our civilization, our way of living and dying, of praying or not praying, of eating and drinking and dressing and studying and enjoying life. Oriana Fallaci was one of the most trenchant observers of the world scene and accomplished political journalists. Originally from Italy, she lived many years in New York, and in 2002 wrote her first book in more than 10 years, The Rage and the Pride. Fallaci's tough-minded design for counterterrorism, Islamic hatred for the West, is, in a fire spread by the wind, lays out the facts clearly for all to see. Some European countries, burdened by huge Muslim populations that are eroding the original cultures of their new European homelands, tried to ban her book, an effort she denounced as intellectual terrorism. Ms. Fallaci gave us all something to think about and to act upon. Michael Barone concluded from his analysis of the facts of the Salafists/Wahhabis that it may not be prudent yet to speak the truth out loud, that the Saudis are our enemies. But they should know that it is increasingly apparent to the American people that they are effectively waging war against us. Writer and keen observer of the world scene Victor David Hansen observed that it is time for Washington to recognize its despotic, oil-rich ally for what it is and act accordingly. War against infidels and unbelievers. There should be no doubt that militant Islamists are conducting a crusade against all of those they consider infidels and unbelievers. Al-Qaeda and other guerrilla groups are simultaneously waging conflict, with terrorism as a major weapon or tactic, against Christians and Jews in the United States and Europe, Hindus in Kashmir and elsewhere in India, Orthodox Russians in Chechnya, moderate Muslims in the Caucasus, and Buddhist Chinese in Xinjiang. Militant Muslims connected with Al-Qaeda are conducting war in Indonesia and the Philippines. Hundreds were killed by Muslim-Christian violence in Nigeria over a beauty pageant and Danish cartoons. The worldwide transnational Islamic revival also extends to many countries where a presence is maintained for recruitment and to build a support structure. Examples might be Kenya, Bali, or the tri-border area between Paraguay, Argentina, and Brazil. The United States, however, remains the primary target, with Europe following close behind. During a September 11, 2002, celebration of the attacks a year earlier, for instance, Islamists in London praised Osama bin Laden as a hero and urged young men to join the effort for victory against American efforts to dominate the world and snatch the Gulf oil fields. Millions of Muslims are people of bright and wonderful smiles. Many wish to be integrated into the modern world, tolerant of other religions and oriented toward democracy. Most Muslims are confident in practicing their faith while learning from the non-Islamic communities. Islamists, on the other hand, are shrouded in darkness and fear, and their supporters, a tiny minority, wish to hold the modern world at an arm's length while they strive to recreate a 7th-century milieu for the practice of a puritanical form of Islam, Wahhabi. Though anchored in a religious creed, Daniel Pipes observes, militant Islam is a radical utopian movement closer in spirit to other such movements such as communism and fascism than traditional religion. By nature anti-democratic and aggressive, anti-Semitic and anti-Western, Pipes adds, militant Islam has great plans. In a word, Wahhabism is driven by a political ideology shrouded inside a religious smokescreen. Hatred of the United States is not so much for things Americans have done, but for who we are. Educated Islamist radicals unleashed a laundry list of real and imagined U.S. policies as reflecting a form of racial and cultural arrogance against Muslims, such as support for Zionism, selfish support of corrupt regimes in the Arab world, and economic dominance and exploitation through globalization leading to poverty and tyranny. Yet, these ostensibly rational elements of American bad deeds are rooted more in the militant Arab world's own failings to devise a workable system of political Islam in which secular government can exist side by side with the Prophet Muhammad's teaching. Muslims possess an intense historical awareness, Bernard Lewis, Princeton University's professor emeritus of Near Eastern Studies, counsels, that leads them to a much deeper and broader perspective of current events than Americans enjoy. In the eyes of Muslims, they are living participants of a profound historical tragedy. The richest and most powerful civilization on earth for centuries was founded on Islam. For 300 years, a Muslim empire was accompanied by a great new civilization. A caliph, recognized as successor to the Prophet, was the supreme ruler of the Muslims. The caliph served as governor, as well as a leader in prayer and in battle. Islam's armies that took the Muslims across northern Africa and into the heart of Europe, including France and Austria. They colonized the Iberian Peninsula, except for some northern areas. Elsewhere, Muslims advanced into Asia Minor and through Iran into Central Asia. Teachers and traders, in their eyes, helped to bring civilization and religion to the infidel barbarians who lived beyond the Muslim frontier. A small Turkish tribe, the Osmandis, conquered a large part of the Balkans in 1413 and captured Constantinople. In 1517, the Sultan Selim conquered Syria and Egypt, and the Ottoman Empire emerged as the universal governor of Islamic territories. The Ottoman campaign against Christian Europe was decisively defeated at the Battle of Vienna in 1683, which brought many Muslims, who were convinced of the superiority of their culture, to seek the reasons for their inferiority of power. The relative position of the Muslim world continued to deteriorate vis-à-vis Western civilization during the succeeding centuries. The resulting frustration of relentless pressures has found expression in contemporary times. Many Westerners are convinced of the superiority of their culture and believe that their advanced technology societies imposes an obligation on them to share their strengths throughout the world. A small group of Wahhabis and a descendant of Ibn Saud formed a brotherhood, Ikhwan, in 1902 dedicated to re-establishing a purified faith by means of jihad. A decade later, Abdul Aziz Ibn Saud, ruler of the Arabian district of Najd, sponsored a spectacular revival of the Wahhabi sect, which gave birth to a fierce warrior brotherhood, Ikhwan, the Brethren. An incredible breakdown in British intelligence occurred in 1915 when, at a cabinet war committee meeting, Sir Mark Sykes expressed the view that Wahhabism is a dying fire. 2 years later, or 5 years after the Warrior Brotherhood began to form, Gilbert Clayton reported from Arabia to Sykes that there were indications that Wahhabi may have experienced some degree of revival. Clayton noted that he did not yet appreciate the strength of the movement, but it may modify the whole situation considerably. The report recognized that Ibn Saud had an army of true Bedouins, the greatest warriors in Arabia. By the end of 1921, Ibn Saud's 150,000-strong fighting men were completing the conquest of Arabia. The following year brought the House of Saud into direct conflict with the British-backed Hashemite Kingdom of Jordan. The British, using aircraft and armored cars, turned back a force of 3,000 to 4,000 Ikhwan raiders just an hour's camel ride from Amman, today's capital of Jordan. In 1922, the British established boundaries upon Saudi Arabia, Iraq, and Kuwait. By 1924, a Saudi Wahhabi conquest of Mecca turned out the Hashemite kingdom, ensuring the Wahhabis the right to collect taxes and fees from pilgrims in Hajj. In 1925, the Saudi Wahhabi reasserted power over the port of Jeddah and the holy city of Medina. The latter was restored to Wahhabi control. And in 1926, a global Islamic conference was called by Ibn Saud to ratify his control over the two holy places. With the discovery of oil by two Americans in 1931, Saudi Arabia passed from the British to the American sphere of influence. A year later, the state of Saudi Arabia was formally established. The House of Saud and its religious co-conspirators, the Wahhabi, were soon transformed into the world's richest and most powerful ruling elite. When the United States assumed Britain's previous oversight of the Middle East activities in 1945, American leaders wanted to show that they sympathized with the Arabs, Persians, and Muslims. The message was supposed to be America was no imperialist power with self-seeking designs on the lands and wealth of other peoples. Following 60-plus years, the United States has no real friends in the region. Why? According to a story told by Max Boot, the U.S. message about not being an imperialist power was actually seen by the Saudis as one of weakness. Perhaps Osama bin Laden best makes the case. When people see a strong horse and a weak horse, By nature, they will take the strong horse. In some ways, a host of past U.S. foreign actions and soft words had demonstrated a profound weakness and lack of resolve that led Bin Laden's faulty perception that the U.S. was a weak horse. He cited numerous events that showed Americans living a depraved and self-indulgent way of life had made them soft and unwilling to accept military casualties, a proverbial weak horse. The litany of American weaknesses was repeated by al-Qaeda members over and over. The U.S. was driven from Vietnam under fire. U.S. Marines left Beirut quickly after a single bombing in 1983 had killed 241 men, and Americans bugged out of Somalia after a ferocious gun battle that killed 18 U.S. soldiers. Hit them, and they will run, Bin Laden and others concluded. Their perception was reinforced by angry words, but little U.S. action following the 1993 World Trade Center bombing, which killed 6 and injured more than 1,000 people. 7 American soldiers killed in a 1995 attack on the liaison mission to Riyadh, Saudi Arabia, but the Bill Clinton, gum-chewing strategists found the attacks an inconvenience. They did little more than give a huff-and-puff soundbite for the media. 19 American airmen were killed and more than 500 injured in a 1996 bombing of the Khobar military living quarters in Riyadh. The U.S. and Saudi Arabia moved the base for Americans to a remote area of desert, while Washington's terrorism investigators were stonewalled by the Saudis, who were less than cooperative in identifying the perpetrators. 2 years later, 224 people were killed and 4,500 wounded in the bombings of the U.S. embassies in Kenya and Tanzania. 20 U.S. cruise missiles were launched, mostly turning large rocks into pebbles at 6 al-Qaeda camps in northeastern Afghanistan and destroying a pharmaceutical plant in Somalia. Sandy Berger, President Clinton's national security advisor, could not keep his mouth shut and in the process babbled mindlessly, undermining the credibility of the strike against the pharmaceutical plant. 17 sailors were killed in a 2000 attack on the USS Cole, a U.S. Navy vessel, while refueling in Yemen. Given this record of years of weak and ineffective responses, it should come as no surprise that the al-Qaeda attacks on September 11, 2001, were supposed to be the opening salvo of a large-scale campaign aimed at driving the U.S. and its allies out of Arabia and the rest of the Muslim world, overthrowing the corrupt tyrants supported by the United States, and preparing the ground for a final world struggle that would restore the predominance of Islam and its values. These terrorists, militant Islamists, hate us for who we are, not what we have done, author Victor Davis Hanson explains. Al-Qaeda is about assuaging the psychological wounds of hundreds of millions of Muslims who are without consensual government, freedom, and material security, Hanson continues. Bin Laden is the ultimate representation of Islam's failure to come to grips with the dizzying pace of globalization and the spread of popular Western culture. For Osama bin Laden and his hate-mongering associates, the United States is a demonic culture that dominates the world. Traditional Islam seeks to teach human beings how to live in accord with God's will. Richard Pipes explains, militant Islam aspires to create a new order. Saudi Arabia's Wahhabi cultists have no moral constraints on the death and destruction left in the wake of their drive toward building one world of puritanical Islamic rule. Theirs is a reverse crusade against the West. The Ikhwan has not forgotten its original intention of engaging jihad against the infidel. Nor have they forgotten that the sacred places had not been given to God but had been taken over by an earthly sovereign who named this holy territory after himself, Saudi Arabia. Civilizational jihad. An analysis of the geopolitics of the Middle East yields insights often not readily apparent to the cursory eye. The Saudis are confronted with the revival of the Shia nation culturally, not in the sense of a political state that includes portions of Iraq, Syria, and Lebanon, and a potentially nuclear-armed Iran. This emerging reality is the stuff worst-case scenarios are made of and keep kings and presidents alike awake at night. It is not surprising, therefore, that Riyadh plans to purchase more than $50 billion on weapons by 2013. $40 billion of the new armament will be in the form of aircraft and related equipment from the United States and Britain, with the remaining $10 billion in military expenditures going to France, Russia, and Pakistan. In exchange for its windfall oil revenues, Saudi Arabia exports hate to the capitalist West in the form of a civilizational jihad, which includes propaganda and disinformation against Christians, Jews, Shias, and moderate Muslims. The tacit boundaries of the Saudi capitalist West geopolitical competition also includes the intolerant Wahhabi religious sect that legitimizes the rule of the Saudi royal family and exports global terrorism. The Muslim Brotherhood, ICWAN, serves as the board of directors for the destruction of non-Islamic civilization in North America. This is hardly a new phenomenon. Israel's Dor Gold quotes Wilfred Cantwell Smith of McGill University, who wrote in 1957, "Most Westerners have simply no inkling of how deep and fierce is the hate of the West that has gripped the modernizing Arab." The strategic goal of the Muslim Brotherhood in North America is civilizational jihad, which includes the destruction of Western civilization through long-term civilization-killing jihad from within, by American and Canadian hands, and through sabotage the hands of the believers, and, secondly, to support the global Islamic movement to establish an Islamic superstate, the Caliphate. This civilization-killing process is described in a Muslim Brotherhood memorandum dated May 22, 1991. Which was accepted into evidence in the U.S. v. Holy Land Foundation trial held in federal court. The ICWAN must understand that their work in America is a kind of grand jihad in eliminating and destroying the Western civilization from within and sabotaging its miserable house by their hands and the hands of believers so that it is eliminated and Allah's religion is made victorious over all other religions. Emphasis and original. The Muslim Brotherhood has three main civilizational jihad tools available to satisfy these strategic goals: infiltration of supporters into America, multiculturalism as a tool for societal transformation, and denial and deception through the Wahhabi lobby. These civilizational jihad measures are all made possible by Saudi oil money and are backed up by the threat and possible terrorist action with conventional, chemical, biological, and radiological weapons and nuclear attacks. Infiltrating America. The terrorist network in the United States since 1991 expanded to more than 50 U.S. cities. Among the leading terrorist groups with presence in multiple areas include the Muslim Brotherhood, Al-Qaeda, Hezbollah, Hamas, Armed Islamic Group, Algeria, and several American homegrown cells. The New York and Washington, D.C., metropolitan areas accommodate 9 and 6 terrorist groups, respectively. The Muslim Brotherhood was represented in 7 major urban areas in 2008. Al-Qaeda was well represented at these locations and in Florida. Hamas was popular in Texas, Louisiana, Mississippi, Missouri, Oklahoma, and Kansas. On the West Coast, Al-Qaeda maintained presence in Washington, Oregon, and California. FBI Director Robert Mueller said in May 2008 that the Bureau had identified small groups of Al-Qaeda terrorists in the United States. Muslims in the United States number about 2.35 million people, or about 0.6% of the total population. According to a 2007 Pew Research Center survey of more than 1,000 American Muslims, about one quarter of those under 30 years of age condone suicide bombings, at least under certain circumstances. Overall, U.S. Muslims lean to the Democratic Party, 6-1. Income distribution for this group is close to the national norm. 28% of the survey respondents do not believe Arabs were responsible for the September 11, 2001, terror attacks. 2/3 expressed an unfavorable view of Al-Qaeda, while 5% had a favorable opinion, 115,000 people. 27%, 621,000 people, said they had no opinion on Al-Qaeda. Despite misgivings by many in the West, Islam is not the post-9/11 enemy of the capitalist West. Rather, Dor Gold points out in Hatred's Kingdom, the problem is the extremists in the Middle East who have manipulated Friday sermons in the mosques, textbooks in the schools, and state-controlled television to one end, to systematically prepare young people to condone the cold-blooded murder of innocent civilians. The problem is that Wahhabism that has been allowed to spawn in Saudi Arabia and is now a thoroughly hate-filled ideology dedicated to mass murder in the United States. To underline the point, Dor Gold quoted an Al-Qaeda spokesman, Suleiman Abu Ghaith, as saying that, "We have a right to kill 4 million Americans, 2 million of them children, and to exile twice as many and wound and cripple hundreds of thousands." Wahhabism has long legitimized extraordinary violence against non-combatants, including women and children, since its earliest days in the 18th and 19th centuries. The unmitigated barbarism that envelopes Wahhabism to this day has been demonstrated many times. When a Wahhabi assault on the fortress of Taif in 1802 resulted in surrender, for instance, the Wahhabis took their swords to 367 men, women, and children, cutting even the babies in cradles. The barbarity of Wahhabism in the current day is expressed clearly in the willingness to conduct suicide bombings against combatants and non-combatants alike, a first step in fulfilling its commitment to destroy the United States from the inside. Al-Qaeda needs to infiltrate the numbers of its killers and with the right skills. Another major concern is homegrown extremists or those inspired by militant Islamic ideology but without operational direction from Al-Qaeda. With the much-reported inadequacies of U.S. immigration and border controls, trace Al-Qaeda's efforts also take advantage of the entry enforcement deficiencies. In Pakistan, Al-Qaeda continues to provide explosives training to Europeans, since they can enter the United States more easily without a visa than those from other countries. David Horowitz laments the persistence of American weakness to shield the nation against Al-Qaeda attacks. In future generations, students of history will marvel that Western civilization failed to believe that it had a right to vigorously defend itself from the sworn enemies who had proudly, unambiguously declared their genocidal intentions. They will marvel at the moral paralysis that prevented America from taking the easily identifiable steps necessary to prevent a recurrence of 9/11 or calamities far greater. Al-Qaeda uses as many guises to infiltrate operators into the United States. The student visa program is a favorite, especially if an agent was denied a U.S. entry visa. American authorities require colleges and universities to monitor such visitors more closely. However, one should take a large grain of salt with the idea that foreign students would ever be placed under effective monitoring by American institutions of higher learning. Al-Qaeda, many believe, are also using medical facilities across the country as a means of gaining entry to the United States. The State Department can issue visitors visas for the purpose of receiving medical treatment in the U.S. on the basis of letters from a valid clinic. In some cases, letters or emails to clinics have requested letters for themselves as groups as large as a dozen people. As of mid-2007, no post 9/11 restrictions on medical facilities issuing invitation letters for foreign national have been issued. Moreover, the State Department had not issued any cautions to the healthcare industry. Another problem is Al-Qaeda operatives posing as medical aides to disabled persons, as well as those presenting themselves as disabled travelers. The Nation of Islam, a vibrant American Black Muslim group, was approached by Saudi Arabia-based Wahhabis who wished to buy their way into a presence inside the United States. Working through the Saudi Arabian embassy, the direct Wahhabi offer to the Nation of Islam included the Americans making 5 visits to Saudi Arabia, including a visit with the Saudi king, crown prince, and other members of the royal family. The Saudis were persistent. "What do you need?" they asked. The Saudis began by placing about $1 million in the Nation of Islam's coffers. The objective was to foster the conversion of Americans to Islam. The Nation of Islam was asked to find a land parcel of about 20 acres for construction of a mosque, 2 schools, and an information center on the outskirts of Chicago. The Saudis also promised to fund 4 more of the centers for Wahhabism. In the meantime, the Saudis funded several mosques across America, Canada, and Europe. The relationship with the Nation of Islam soured, and the Saudis pulled out. Muslim American activism preceded the terrorist events on September 11, 2001. A new Millennium Conference on America and Islam was held at Georgetown University in April 2000. More than 50 of the world's most prominent scholars, activists, and academicians joined their American counterparts and policymakers in Washington, D.C. Topics addressed included an Islamic vision for the 21st century, with a particular focus placed on political Islam. Former Speaker of the Jordanian Parliament Dr. Abdul Latif Arabi believes that the Islamic world has a right and obligation to provide visions for the upcoming century. His commentary provided a comprehensive statement of the primary geo-religious competition with Russia and the capitalist West in the 21st century. This world suffers from tyranny, injustice, oppressive imperialism, and purposeful defamation of its thought, creed, and human message, he said. The Islamic world feels it has a massive treasure of global values and principles that humanity needs if it hopes to fix the foundations of modern civilization. The relationship between Islam and the West had become strained following 9/11, Al-Qaeda's persistent terrorist threat, and the willingness of the Saudi government and royal family to fund the overseas activities of the Muslim Brotherhood and Wahhabi. Yet, for some, money talks. Georgetown University, the Jesuit-run Roman Catholic institution, was quick to announce the receipt of a $20 million gift to endow the university's Center for Muslim-Christian Understanding by Saudi Prince Al-Walid bin Talal, the new center's namesake. The page one headline in the Washington Times was appropriate: Saudis buy a campus presence. Another $20 million gift was ponied up for a similar program at Harvard University. Many believe that the size of the donations amount to little more than buying influence and creating bastions of non-critical pro-Islamic scholarship within academia. Clifford May, president of the Foundation for Defense of Democracies, pointed out that professors on Middle Eastern studies tend to reflect the concerns of Arab and Muslim rulers. In a word, those who do not play the game as defined by the gifter are unlikely to last long or gain a tenured position on college campuses. Clifford May adds that sometimes money is a bribe. Sometimes it is a tip. The Georgetown University's HRH Prince Al-Walid bin Talal Center for Muslim-Christian Understanding drew considerable attention. Patrick Poole, writing for frontpagemagazine.com, examined the center's internal workings, noting that Director John L. Esposito had a long history of vocal support and praise of his self-described good friend, convicted Palestinian Islamic Jihad leader Sami Al-Arian. Martin Kramer, a fellow at the Olin Institute at Harvard, writes that John Esposito has proved that he is a money magnet for Arab and Muslim money. And Winfield Myers writes that Esposito blames the West for troubled relations with the Islam world, rather than the way his benefactors' billions support the spread of the Wahhabi Islam around the globe, including the Georgetown section of Washington, D.C. Susan Douglas is the center's educational consultant. She was an instructor at the Islamic Saudi Academy in Alexandria, Virginia, for many years, which is funded by the Saudi government and known among some media outlets as Terror High. The U.S. Commission on International Religious Freedom notified the U.S. Senate in October 2007 that the academy of some 933 students was in violation of U.S. law. The commission reported that the textbooks used at the Saudi Academy contained highly intolerant and discriminatory language, particularly against Jews, Christians, and Sharia Muslims. The textbooks teach students to hate Jews, Christians, polytheists, and other unbelievers. They also state, in line with the civilizational jihad, that violent jihad is a religious duty. Hadia Mubarak is the Georgetown Center's senior researcher. Like Susan Douglas, Mubarak has held top leadership positions in front organizations for the International Muslim Brotherhood. Mubarak is a former president of the Muslim Student Association and national broad member of the Council on American-Islamic Relations, CARE. Both organizations were identified in 2007 by the U.S. Department of Justice as unindicted co-conspirators and fronts for the Brotherhood. U.S. Representative Frank R. Wolf, a Georgetown graduate, wrote Dr. John J. DeGioia, the university president, and asked if the size of the gift could place the center's academic independence in jeopardy. Congressman Wolf also expressed his concern that Georgetown University's role in training foreign service personnel and diplomats would be at odds with Saudi links to extremism and terrorism. Wolf also asked Dr. DeGioia to assess whether any of the Saudi source funds have been used in the training, briefing, or education of those going into or currently employed by the U.S. government. The HRH Prince Al-Walid bin Talal Center for Muslim-Christian Understanding at Georgetown University is a case example for fostering civilizational jihad. It is all about destroying American culture from within and preparing for a time when Islam will emerge dominant over other religions inside the United States. Multiculturalism. A second tool for civilizational jihad is the reversal of Western ideas about multiculturalism. Popular with those on the radical left applying Antonio Gramsci's formula for transforming American culture, multiculturalism is also a two-sided coin in the hands of the Muslim Brotherhood. Multiculturalism in the 1980s took a meaning in North America and Europe to support the culture war, that would lead to a progressive socialist Marxist society. In the early 2000s, the idea of multiculturalism shed its anti-capitalist bias and assumed a revised meaning: assimilation and ethnicity. Peggy Storhawk, a Norwegian specialist on Islamic integration issues, explains that multiculturalism has been transformed from the idea of economic equality to cultural equality. But since 9/11, Europeans and Americans have come to increasingly regard immigrants, especially Muslims, as being cultural threats, a source of hostility to the European and American ways of life, and a potential source or inspiration of additional terrorist attacks. The United States confronts two faces of terrorist threats. One is external and reflected by Al-Qaeda, and the other are homegrown jihadists. Many of the latter group are drawn from Muslim communities in the West. Law enforcement officials have focused increasingly on the factors that are drawn into the radicalization process of the indigenous terrorists. Several commonalities in the pre-radicalization process have been identified from careful review of case studies. The second phase of radicalization is self-identification, in which individuals begin to examine the fundamentalism of Wahhabism. This religious seeking opens the individual to new worldviews and begins shifting their identity to associate with like-minded individuals and adopt jihad ideology and values as their own. Two indicators of progression along the radicalization continuum include a gravitation toward Wahhabi Islam and regular attendance to a Salafi mosque. Typical signatures of the self-identified include alienation from their former lives, affiliating with like-minded individuals or group to strengthen one's dedication to Wahhabi Islam, giving up cigarettes, drinking, gambling, and urban hip-hop gangster clothes, wearing traditional Islamic clothing, growing a beard, and involving themselves in social activism and community issues. Stage 3 of the radicalization process involves indoctrination. This is a big step by the individual toward intensifying his beliefs to the point that the jihadi Wahhabi ideology is wholly adopted. It is at this point that the journeyman jihadist concludes, without question, that militant jihad action is required to further the Wahhabi cause. A spiritual sanctioner is critical during this phase. This person typically appears in the self-identification stage and remains a major influence through the indoctrination phase. Often a self-taught Islamic scholar, who transmits an us versus them worldview. Jihadization, phase 4, occurs when the members of a cell see themselves as holy warriors or mujahideen. The cell or cluster will begin planning for jihad or terrorist attacks. Target selection and operational planning will commence. Sometimes this will involve travels to a militant training camp overseas. The cell leaders typically pursue this travel, which serves as a catalyst for group action. Attack planning involves researching the internet, reconnaissance and surveillance, acquiring explosive materials, creating an explosive device, and developing ingress and egress plans and procedures. The subtle methods applied to the radicalization process often do not involve lawbreaking, placing law enforcement authorities at a disadvantage. In many ways, the radicalization continuum for a homegrown Wahhabi jihadist is very similar to the techniques used by communists in recruiting new members. Brian Michael Jenkins, a senior advisor to the president of the RAND Corporation, notes appropriately that radicalization makes little noise. It borders on areas protected by the First and Fourth Amendments. It takes place over a long period of time. It therefore does not lend itself to a traditional criminal investigations approach. Another important aspect of the civilizational jihad is through use of multiculturalism in subverting America's public schools. Stanley Kurtz, a National Review online contributing editor, offers a simple proposition: unless we counteract the influence of Saudi money on the education of the young, we're going to find it difficult to win the war on terror. The young Mr. Kurtz is referring to are those in K-12 education in the United States. The Saudis have co-opted and seized control over Middle Eastern and Islamic studies in the United States with surprising ease. According to Stanley Kurtz's analysis, the Saudis subverted Title VI of the U.S. Higher Education Act by using it as a Trojan horse. The federal government subsidizes centers for Middle Eastern studies to design lesson plans and seminars for K-12 teachers in American schools. In the absence of effective federal oversight, the university-distributed teaching aids for K-12 find their way into the curricula without public vetting. But the Saudis beforehand bought and paid for those curricula. Meanwhile, Mr. Kurtz explains, the American government is asleep at the wheel, paying scant attention to how its federally mandated public outreach programs actually work. So without ever realizing it, America's taxpayers end up subsidizing and providing official federal approval for K-12 educational materials on the Middle East that have been created under Saudi auspices. The common denominator of this sleight of hand is Saudi money. The educational materials bypassing school boards, fooling the federal government, and taking advantage of America's goodwill sometimes praise and promote Islam, while they criticize Judaism and Christianity. Stanley Kurtz quotes a 2005 investigative report by the Jewish Telegraphic Agency, believing they're importing the wisdom of places like Harvard or Georgetown. Americans are actually inviting into their schools whole curricula and syllabuses developed with the support of Riyadh. Saudi efforts to propagandize American K-12 students about Middle Eastern studies and Islam, while pouring a sewer line of disinformation and hatred about Jews, Christians, Shias, and others is not limited to lesson plans and teacher training. Saudi money influence is also exerted through textbooks for public school children K-12. Susan L. Douglas is one of those at the center of the textbook storm. For at least 10 years, a teacher at the notorious Islamic Saudi Academy in Alexandria, Virginia, which teaches Wahhabism through textbooks, is now a senior staff member of Georgetown University's Prince Al-Walid bin Talal Center. According to Paul Sperry, Douglas has convinced American textbook publishers and educators to gloss over the violent aspects of Islam to make the faith more appealing to non-Muslim children. William J. Benetta, a fellow of the California Academy of Sciences and president of the Textbook League, wrote in the summer 2000 that Prentice Hall's high school text, World Culture, a Global Mosaic, serves as a vehicle for Muslim propaganda, and that Houghton Mifflin's seventh grade text, Across the Centuries, is loaded with Muslim religious propaganda. In addition, a textbook published by the Teachers Curriculum Institute, History Alive, The Medieval World and Beyond, was removed from the Scottsdale, Arizona, school district in 2005 for misrepresenting and glorifying Islamic beliefs and history. In February 2008, the textbook caused a controversy in California. At the center was a gentleman named Alkazaz, a specialist in Middle East studies, who was a contributor to History Alive, and one of those who approved its use in public middle schools. Beyond curriculum and textbook issues, America's schools are being increasingly besieged by special requests to accommodate Muslim religious needs. American schools are sensitive to religious requirements and usually can be found to be seeking responsible ways to satisfy students' needs. Some things, such as excusing Muslim children from gym class during Ramadan fasting, are easy to accommodate, including separate lunch areas for reduced diet students or alternative locations where children can pray. On the other hand, some religious groups complain that special arrangements are made available to Muslim students that would not be open to Christians at an equivalent level. The allegation of a double standard was raised when Muslim students were given a break to pray in the classroom. A class time praying session by Christians would never have been allowed. The University of Michigan at Dearborn was criticized in 2007 for planning to install foot baths in two restrooms to make it easier for Muslim students to cleanse before daily prayers. It was reported in September 2007 that schools in Oak Lawn, Illinois, might cancel Halloween and Christmas activities after complaints were received that they were offensive, especially to Muslim students. Attacks against existing American culture are an unending tactic of civilizational jihad. The Saudi offensive to co-opt and control of the curricula, textbooks, and special privileges in American schools is all about replacing Kafir, non-Muslim, multiculturalism with Islamic multiculturalism. Each step is one more toward the uncompromising goal of establishing the supremacy of Islam, primacy of Arabs, and the global Islamic Ummah, Muslim community. As Abdul Qasim observed, the Islamists have nothing to worry about in terms of their agenda to eventually impose Islam on the infidel lands. The politicians of the infidel territories are doing their job for them, i.e., promoting Islam. Denial and deception, Wahhabi lobby. The Muslim Brotherhood, the Al-Ikhwan al-Muslimin, consists of about 70 U.S. national organizations, each with their own agendas within broad guidelines of an international directorate. The Brotherhood's shared creed is, God is our objective, The Quran is our constitution, the Prophet is our leader, jihad is our way, and death for the sake of God is the highest of our operations. The Muslim Brotherhood in North America operates behind a series of front groups typified by what is called the Wahhabi Lobby by American and Canadian analysts. The goal of the Brotherhood's denial and deception efforts has little to do with civil rights, anti-discrimination, student associations, and similar soft activities. Rather, this cover is used to hide its true goal in the world's shadows, destroy the United States from the inside, and work for the establishment of a global Islamist society. The Brotherhood's strategic concept is sound and well thought out. It is oriented to a patient, long-term organizational approach toward creating and developing organizations and networks that implement civilizational jihad. The Brotherhood in America has been implementing this strategy since 1962, beginning with establishing its first Muslim student union through a program of conferences and camps. By the 1970s, the Ikhwan began establishing affiliated vocational and professional organizations, such as Muslim doctors, social workers, and science and engineer syndicates. In 1981, the Brotherhood in North America founded the Islamic Association of Palestine, whose work is linked with the Palestinian Intifada and the Hamas terror organization. Rod Dreher, Dallas Morning News, says that the Brotherhood operates as a self-conscious revolutionary vanguard in the United States. The axis of the Brotherhood are Islamic religious and educational centers. The centers serve as the hub for a small Islamic society, which mirrors the Ikhwan's key organizations. These centers serve social and family needs of the Muslim community, but also are placed in service of the political goals of destroying existing American culture, establishing a caliphate in North America. The centers also are propaganda and disinformation houses to keep any wayward thinking in line. They are instrumental in maintaining the Brotherhood's internal structure, discipline, recruitment, and special work or military work aimed at securing the group's security against outside dangers, including U.S. and state law enforcement and intelligence, Zionism, and other American fronts. A network of Wahhabi-sponsored propaganda and disinformation organizations underwrite the Muslim Brotherhood's goal of transforming America into an Islamic-loving caliphate in the new geopolitical order later in the 21st century. Through use of numerous and inventive salami tactics, the Wahhabi lobby operating under the guidance of the Muslim Brotherhood is dedicated to developing a fifth column of support for militant Islam in America and establishing an Islamic caliphate. 8 lobby organizations, 6 in particular, provide the basis for the Brotherhood's operations. 1. Council for American Islamic Relations CARE. This element of the Saudi Wahhabi religious militia was modeled after an American Jewish organization, the Anti-Defamation League. CARE's 1994 charter is a model of moderation, promote interest and understanding among the general public with regards to Islam and understanding among the general public with regards to Islam and Muslims in North America. A spin-off of the Islamic Association of Palestine, CARE generally lays claim to representing the Muslim viewpoint in America. CARE provides support for militant Islamists in their spewing of anti-Semitism and anti-Israel disinformation. For instance, CARE co-sponsored a rally at Brooklyn College in May 1998, providing a platform for Waghdi Ghunayem, a radical cleric from Egypt. Among his racist remarks, he led the audience in a song with the lyrics, "No to the Jews, descendants of the apes." When billboards around Los Angeles depicting Osama bin Laden with the headline "The Sworn Enemy" was posted in October 1998 by a local television station, CARE stated that they were an insult to the hundreds of thousands of Muslims who live in Southern California. CARE is a major front in the network of political Islam organization dedicated to civilizational jihad inside the United States. Jihad means the legal, compulsory, communal effort to expand the territories ruled by non-Muslims, Daniel Pipes explains. The purpose of jihad is not directly to spread the Islamic faith, but to extend sovereign Muslim power. CARE enjoys a key position in the Wahhabi lobby, despite its mainstream and wholesome appearance, Daniel Pipes and Sharon Chutta summarized. The Council on American Islamic Relations is the leading Islamist apologist in the United States and, as such, is a major influence on the enemy's side in the war on terror. 2. Islamic Society of North America, ISNA. The Union of Orthodox Jewish Congregations, analyst Stephen Schwartz says, provided the model for the creation of ISNA, the second element of the Saudi Wahhabi religious militia inside the United States. 63, located in Plainfield, Indiana, ISNA is the largest Muslim organization in the United States. It was founded in 1981. The society operates as an umbrella organization or clearinghouse for networking all Saudi Wahhabi activities in the United States. This hub of the Saudi Fifth Column provides a large percentage of the Wahhabi theological indoctrination materials to a significant percentage of the more than 2,500 mosques in North America. Many of these mosques were built with Saudi money. Among the strings attached to the Saudi money is that those who take the cash are bound to strictly follow the instruction of Wahhabi imams. These strings include the towing the line on the tone and content of sermons delivered in the Saudi-paid-for mosques, assuring that the books and periodicals made available in mosque libraries or sold in its bookstores are drawn from Saudi-approved sources, and following the Saudi policies governing the suppression of dissenters within the congregations. Stephen Emerson, a courageous investigative journalist focused on Wahhabi extremism in North America, is very careful to avoid accusing ISNA of having a direct involvement in terrorism. He does say, however, that ISNA has sponsored extremists, racists, people who call for jihad against the United States. 3. Muslim Students Association. Islamic extremism has been reported as growing at universities and colleges for several years. The increased activities of the Muslim Students Association result from a presence on at least 600 campuses, about 150 of which are affiliated with the national organization. The national and local chapters of the MSA are loosely associated. It is not rare to find the positions of specific chapters differing in some ways from the national association. A 1991 Muslim Brotherhood memorandum, however, made it quite clear the MSA was one of its like-minded organizations of our friends, members, and associates of the Saudi Religious Militia, or Wahhabi Lobby. 4. Islamic Circle of North America, ICNA. Boiling in a cauldron of fierce hatred for Jews, the ICNA consists of a radical Islamic organization, the Pakistani Jamaat-e Islami, that helped to establish the Taliban. ICNA also enjoys direct ties with Al-Qaeda terrorists. It offers high praise for terrorist attacks, highly critical commentary of Western values and policies, and advocates the imposition of Islamic law, the Sharia. Anti-American, radical Islamists are often invited to ICNA's annual conferences. It also has ties with Muslim organizations that find suicide bombings as being justifiable. 5. Muslim American Society, MAS. Founded in 1993, the Muslim American Society is a major front for the Muslim Brotherhood in North America and, as such, is dedicated to placing the United States under the governance of the Sharia or Islamic law. Adopting a version of Antonio Gramsci's formula, the gradual approach to achieving Islamic rule is advocated. First you change the person, then the family, then the community, then the nation. That is to say, first you convert Americans to Islam, and then you elect like-minded Muslims to political office. The modus operandi was very simple. MAS and the Brotherhood would deny any affiliation, while their strategy, though being prosecuted under different names, was the same: the transformation of American society through the spread of Islam, with the ultimate goal of establishing Islamic rule in America. The following snapshot of the Islamic cultural assault against the United States exposes the Wahhabi lobby efforts to satisfy Saudi Arabia's geopolitical drive to dominate America and the world through the imposition of Islam and global rule of the Sharia. Working for Islam equally means to form a society that is committed to the Islamic way of thinking and Islamic way of life, which means to form a government that implements principles of justice embodied in the Sharia to guard the rights of every person and community, and establish truth and justice, and at the same time call others toward Islam, truth, peace, and justice. These three responsibilities are obligatory not merely for the entire Muslim community, but for every individual Muslim until we have established a system of governance adequate to the task. Until the nations of the world have functionally Islamic governments, every individual who is careless or lazy in working for Islam is sinful. These sins of omission will not be forgiven until they take a quick action to carry out all their responsibilities and Islamic duties. 6. Muslim Public Affairs Council, MPC. This organization is a rather weak Saudi Wahhabi imitation of the American Israel Public Affairs Committee, APAC. MPC was founded in 1988 in Los Angeles as a nonprofit social welfare organization claiming to be a public service agency working for the civil rights of American Muslims, for the integration of Islam into American pluralism, and for a positive, constructive relationship between American Muslims and their representatives. During an October 2000 rally in Washington, D.C., PAC's political advisor, Dr. Mahdi Bray, was seen excitedly professing his support for Hamas and Hezbollah, two of the most deadly terrorist organizations. In December 2000, Mahdi Bray organized a rally outside the White House. The crowd chanted in Arabic to the MC leading them, "Kabar, Kabar, O Jews, the army of Muhammad is coming for you." Posters equated the Star of David with the Nazi swastika, and anti-Semitic literature was distributed. When 15 people, including 6 children, were killed in a suicide bombing of a pizza parlor in Jerusalem in August 2001, MPC issued a press release calling the bombing the expected result of the reckless policy of Israeli assassination that did not spare children and political figures. MPC also said Hezbollah's truck bombing of the U.S. Marine barracks in Beirut as a military operation rather than a terrorist attack. MPC joined the anti-war organization Code Pink for Peace. The organization also worked closely with International Answer and the Marxist-Leninist Workers' World Party. 7. Arab American Institute, AI. This self-described nonpartisan group is not a part of the Saudi Muslim Brotherhood conspiracy to transform the United States and others in the capitalist West to a dimitit status under Islamic governance. In fact, it is dominated by Christians. Muslims account for only about a quarter of its membership. Yet, many share concerns about the conflicts in the Middle East and the wartime accommodations to the realities of post-9/11 America that have triggered fear and uncertainty among some Arab Americans. 8. American Arab Anti-Discrimination Committee, ADC. James Zogby and Senator James Aburesk, the first Arab American to serve in the U.S. Senate, 1973 to 1979, founded this non-religious civil rights group in 1980. It opposes the U.S. War on Terror and Patriot Act, ethnic profiling of Arab Americans, and supports Palestinian martyrdom campaigns in Israel. In 2003, it was a signatory to a letter for members of Congress exhorting them to oppose the Patriot Act too. Other signatories from the radical left included the American Civil Liberties Union, American Library Association, Center for Constitutional Rights, National Lawyers Guild, and People for the American Way. The committee is heavily funded by Wahhabi Saudi Prince Al-Walid bin Talal. Senator Aburesk, a senior advisor for presidential candidate Barack Obama, stirred up some animosities in 1979 when he signed on to serve as the American lawyer for Ayatollah Ruhollah Khomeini Revolutionary Islamic Government during the Iran hostage crisis. Aburesk in 2002 asked Saul Landau, a fellow at the Institute for Policy Studies, to join him and others on a humanitarian mission to Iraq being organized by U.S. Representative Nick Rahal, a Democrat from West Virginia. During the show and tell propaganda tour in Baghdad, Aburesk and Rahal stepped aside for private talks with Iraq Deputy Prime Minister Tariq Aziz. 77 in 2007. He explained that the 9/11 attacks were all about a handful of hapless Arabs who were exploited by Zionists who were really responsible. The attacks were based on the Arabs' unknowing cooperation with the Zionists. It was all about racism to Senator Aburesk. Meanwhile, the senator has always been quick to dismiss the acts of violence by Muslims and the bloody deeds of Hamas and Hezbollah. These ravings, Robert Spencer suggests, is evidence of a man who has lost his moral compass. Weapons of mass destruction. Unfortunately for humankind, the proliferation horse is out of the barn. The Undersecretary of Defense for Intelligence, retired Lieutenant General James Clapper, told a joint hearing of House Armed Services and Intelligence Committees that Al-Qaeda has and will continue to attempt visually dramatic mass casualty attacks here at home, and they will continue to attempt to acquire chemical, biological, radiological, and nuclear materials, adding that if they are successful, we believe they would use them. The possibility of terrorist groups, such as Al-Qaeda, being in possession of weapons of mass destruction and with the will to use them against soft, mass casualty targets presents nightmare scenarios that Western leaders must deal with. Since the United States is target number one for the Islamic fascists, no stone can be left unturned in rooting out and destroying their mass-killing capabilities. The consequences of failure could mean the death of tens of thousands of Americans and Europeans, perhaps even hundreds of thousands of lives. The sarin nerve gas attacks against the Tokyo commuter train system in 1995 showed how effective chemical weapons can be, even when delivered in a less than optimal manner. The anthrax attacks through the mails in the United States by persons unknown following the September 11, 2001, demonstrated the ease of covert delivery of biological weapons. Osama bin Laden has been less than bashful since the 1990s about his desire to obtain weapons of mass destruction. According to press reports, bin Laden was known to have been seeking nuclear capabilities. Although Pentagon analysts believe he was unsuccessful, the Arab press was full of speculation in 1999 as to whether al-Qaeda had gained access to 20 nuclear suitcase bombs, allegedly developed by the Soviet Union during the Cold War. Rumors of the disappearance of these bombs, more the size of a steamer trunk than a suitcase, further inflamed the Arab media's speculation. One senior Pentagon official said in late 2001 that al-Qaeda had already developed a crude chemical and possibly biological capability. The CIA reported in 2004 that al-Qaeda had an interest in radiological dispersal devices for dirty bombs. In November 2002, British authorities arrested an al-Qaeda operative named Rabah Kadri for plotting a chemical attack on the London subway system. Questioning Rabah, as Kenneth Timmerman recounts the events, led authorities to a French-Algerian dual national, Marwan Ben Ahmed, who had collected all of the ingredients necessary for building a bomb to have been delivered during the Christmas holidays, perhaps against the U.S. or Russian embassies in Paris. Ben Ahmed was operating in coordination with al-Qaeda cells in Britain and elsewhere. French police raided a housing project just outside Lyon on Christmas Eve, and they seized more than four al-Qaeda operatives. They also found lists of chemicals needed to make cyanide, the same agent that was to have been used against the London subway system. The cyanide was to be released from propane tanks in the hopes of killing hundreds or thousands of people. More than 40 al-Qaeda sites were identified in Afghanistan in late 2001 by General Tommy Franks, commander of U.S. forces, that represent potential for WMD, weapons of mass destruction, research or things of that sort. Nothing specific about chemical, biological, or nuclear weapons, however, could be found. Subsequent exploitation of the al-Qaeda data captured led the CIA to report that the group was focused on anthrax for mass killing. A year later, Pakistani authorities reported three small al-Qaeda laboratories for the development of weapons of mass destruction had been discovered in a village near Karachi. According to the report, al-Qaeda had moved much of its lab equipment to other countries in the region with the help of gold smugglers. The local terrorists near Karachi had been trained in Afghanistan before September 11th and had been working with al-Qaeda since the fall of the Taliban. The Polish press reported in May 2004 that al-Qaeda terrorists obtained nuclear and biological materials from the Solntsevo organized crime gang. Semen Mogilevich heads this notorious Russian crime group that traffics in nuclear materials, drugs, prostitutes, precious gems, and stolen art. Three members of the Solntsevo gang were arrested on their way to Munich with 17 ounces of smuggled plutonium. Osama bin Laden's quest to develop chemical, biological, and nuclear weapons did not start from zero. At hand was an extensive knowledge base in Iraq and Pakistan of how to develop WMD clandestinely and deliver them with devastating consequences. During the Cold War in the 1980s, East Germany maintained a 12,000-acre terrorist training camp at Moskau, located not far from Berlin. Moskau did not officially exist, yet several Iraqi agents were trained there in the use of chemical and biological weapons. These WMD first mass casualty seeds planted in Islamic countries. East Germany's secret police, the Stasi, are reported to have trained Iraq hit squads and other terrorist groups in the art of placing explosives, poisoning water reservoirs, and planning chemical and biological weapons attacks, including Baghdad resident and international terrorist Abu Nidal. Much of the concrete facility was underground, and a maze of tunnels led to the hidden training building with a ventilation system, steel double doors, and the poison gas was controlled with the help of tight seals. The Mosul terrorist school operated through 1988. This training of Saddam Hussein's secret terrorist army has been linked by British journalist Gwyn Roberts with the nerve gas poisoning of Kurds in the 1980s. The Stasi training of the Iraqis was later shifted to Iraq by Stasi officers who chose not to return to the newly unified Germany. Iraqis were taught with an emphasis on nerve gases and their terrorist uses. Discussion also focused on the possibilities of bacterial weapons, such as anthrax, pneumonic diseases, and hepatitis. Chemical attacks against airports, train stations, and public events were also a part of the curricula in East Germany and later in Iraq during the 1990s. The Stasi, an extension of the KGB, was supporting Soviet policies during the 1970s by training and sometimes equipping foreign terrorists and then returning them to their countries with the freedom to carry out their own terrorist attacks to destroy Western democracies. This model appears to be the framework of the new Al-Qaeda that emerged after being chased out of Afghanistan. The late investigative journalist Claire Sterling put it this way. In effect, the Soviet Union had simply laid a loaded gun on the table, leaving others to get on with it. Since the collapse of the Soviet Union, one might paraphrase and say, in effect, Iraq had simply laid the expertise about WMD on the table, leaving others to get on with it. The UN inspections following the 1991 Gulf War found 23 chemical facilities in Iraq that were producing nerve agents Tabun, sarin, and VX, as well as mustard gas. VX is the most deadly agent. A single pinhead-sized droplet can result in death. The UN supervised the destruction of 480,000 liters of chemical agents, of which 28,000 liters were filled in munitions, bombs, artillery rounds. Another 1.8 million liters of chemical precursors were also destroyed. Unlike Iraq's chemical weapons, the country's biological weapons program was easy to hide. Iraq had 7 core biological weapons sites, 22 storage bunkers, and numerous dual-use, civilian and military, sites, perhaps as many as 79. These dual-use sites included vaccine and pharmaceutical facilities, research and university facilities, breweries, distilleries, dairies, and diagnostic laboratories. Following discovery of the clandestine biological weapons program in 1995, the UN Special Commission on Iraq destroyed what the Iraqis declared 19,000 liters of botulinum toxin with nearly 10,000 liters in munitions, 8,500 liters of concentrated anthrax with some 6,000 liters filled in munitions, and 2,200 liters of aflatoxin, a cancer-causing agent, with 1,580 filled munitions. Theoretically, the killing power of the botulinum toxin alone was enough to kill 15 billion people. Saddam Hussein also was well down the path toward building his own nuclear weapons. After the Gulf War and extent of the nuclear program fully exposed, Western scientists estimated that Iraq was 12 to 18 months away from having nuclear weapons. Saddam had pumped $10 to $12 billion in building 3 uranium enrichment programs and the large foreign procurement program operating through deceptive practices. All told, 56 nuclear production sites were identified by the UN Special Commission of Iraq. These sites included uranium mining, production, and processing sites. Saddam Hussein's program is believed to have produced nuclear triggers, 2 of which are unaccounted for. Hans Blix, director on the UN International Atomic Energy Administration, said that he was shocked by the enormity of Iraq's nuclear weapons program. Richard Danzig, a former secretary of the Navy, probably best characterized the West's current situation. Only a thin wall of terrorist ignorance and inexperience now protects us. 9L, Qaeda may have already penetrated the thin wall, protecting Western societies from biological attacks. One must simply assemble the brainpower of scientists and engineers necessary to make deadly biological agents suitable for dissemination against Western targets. Delivery vehicles could be used by suicide terrorists seeking a one-way pass to paradise. According to the courtroom testimony of Egyptian Islamic Jihad member Ahmad Ibrahim al-Najjar, Osama bin Laden paid $10,000 for anthrax and other germs, such as E. coli and Salmonella, from private laboratories in East European and Southeast Asia. One was a Czech factory that turns out germs to fill mail orders and sells to anyone who pays in advance. The germ source in Southeast Asia is cheaper. A jihadist website in March 2008 posted instructions on making anthrax suitable for biological weapons. The wait has been long, but the time has arrived, God willing. It is glad tidings of being able to use biological weapons against the enemies of God. So, allow me to present to you a simple recipe for making anthrax, God willing. Britain's intelligence service, MI5, reported in June 2003 that it was only a matter of time until Al-Qaeda developed radiological weapons. While the CIA issued a report in May 2003 that suggested Al-Qaeda and other terrorist groups were already capable of making an improvised nuclear device capable of producing a nuclear explosion. As reported by Steve Call, a managing editor at the Washington Post, Osama bin Laden since at least the late 1990s has been quietly working on chemical and biological weapons while far more open on his nuclear weapons goals in public. His inspiration is drawn from the American atomic bombing at Nagasaki and Hiroshima, which shocked the Japanese government into surrendering, a course they may not have otherwise taken. Hence, Call explains, bin Laden wants to do to American foreign policy what the United States did to Japanese surrender policy. The open question is, how would Al-Qaeda go about getting the bomb, or perhaps he has already obtained nuclear bombs? Basically, two realistic pathways are open to Al-Qaeda: buy or steal existing weapons, or buy enough plutonium or highly enriched uranium to build its own improvised nuclear devices. The most plausible route might be to build a crude, yield-producing device using uranium stolen from the former Soviet Union. U.S. counterterrorism experts believe that Osama bin Laden would prefer buying weapons from criminal sources in Russia and Pakistan with inside assistance on how to detonate them. Al-Qaeda and other terrorist groups might best apply a gun-type fission device to trigger an explosion, similar to the bomb dropped on Hiroshima. The bomb dropped on Nagasaki was an implosion device, which is more difficult to make. The gun-type device contains two subcritical masses, gunpowder, and an explosive device that sets off the gunpowder, causing one piece of the subcritical uranium to hit the other, creating a critical mass and an explosion. Numerous news reports and unclassified intelligence reports make it quite clear that Al-Qaeda is attempting to obtain nuclear capability, or it already has such a capacity. Some allege connections with the secretive Pakistani nuclear bomb maker Abdul Qadir Khan and other nuclear scientists, as well as obtaining materials illegally from Pakistan. Others claim that bin Laden got his hands on former Soviet suitcase nukes, and some report the Balashika Russian criminal gang and other crime groups as supplying Al-Qaeda with small amounts of uranium over time. Nuclear 9/11. Nuclear proliferation is a fact of life in the 21st century. Not only have Israel, North Korea, India, and Pakistan joined the nuclear club since late in the last century, but Saddam Hussein was only 18 months away from a nuclear capability when the Gulf War broke out in 1991. Iran stands on the threshold of developing nuclear weapons. Rumors persist that Japan has a standby capability for rapid breakout, and Brazil is believed to be giving thought to resurrecting its earlier flirtation with the possible development of nuclear materials and perhaps weapons. These are all serious possibilities and concerns on this crowded planet. Especially bothersome is a dream scenario shared by Osama bin Laden and Ayman al-Zawahiri, Al-Qaeda's primary leaders, to strike the United States with nuclear weapons on its soil. According to former CIA Director George Tenet, bin Laden and al-Zawahiri went so far as early as 1996 to hire an Egyptian physicist to work on nuclear and chemical projects in Sudan. Tenet writes, "But of all al-Qaeda's efforts to obtain other forms of WMD, the main threat is the nuclear one. I am convinced that this is where UBL, Osama bin Laden, and his operatives desperately want to go. They understand that bombings by cars, trucks, trains, and planes will get them some headlines, to be sure. But if they manage to set off a mushroom cloud, they will make history. Such an event would place Al-Qaeda on a par with the superpowers and make good bin Laden's threat to destroy our economy and bring death into every American household. Even in the darkest days of the Cold War, we could count on the fact that the Soviets, just like us, wanted to live. Not so with terrorists. Al-Qaeda boasts that while we fear death, they embrace it. Despite rigorous efforts by the United States and other major powers, the nuclear proliferation horse had burst out of the barn and was at a full gallop in mid-2008. The pressures are especially intense in the Middle East, where the prospect of a nuclear-armed Iran-Shia is distressing to several Sunni states in the region, including Saudi Arabia. Syria, increasingly drawn into Tehran's political orbit, contracted with North Korea to build it a copy of its Yongbyon reactor at Al-Kabar, which was destroyed by Israel before completion in September 2007. At the same time, A.Q. Khan, the head of Pakistan's nuclear program and a man with a burning hatred toward the United States, operated a covert smuggling ring in the Middle East. He sold blueprints for development of advanced nuclear weapons suitable for delivery by ballistic missiles, as well as associated technology and components to Iran, Libya, and North Korea. Khan's digitized bomb design turned up in the computer files of Swiss smugglers in 2004. And at least one official at the UN International Atomic Energy Agency expressed a belief that the Swiss were not the only ones in possession of Khan's nuclear designs. Perhaps Joseph Surincioni at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace summarized the nuclear proliferation situation in 2008 best. In the last year, we've uncovered probably the most significant hemorrhaging of nuclear weapons technology since the Soviets penetrated the Manhattan Project, 1947. These selected examples of ongoing nuclear proliferation activities raise the obvious question as to whether Al-Qaeda has participated in A.Q. Khan's nuclear smuggling network. The answer is affirmative, if one believes at least the broad outline of the attack scenario presented by a said-to-be Al-Qaeda operative, Ali Sukuf, presented in the appendix. It quotes in chilling detail the anatomy of a nuclear 9/11 attack plan against the United States. The scenario has been rolling around in the internet since 2002, but some have been reluctant to publish it for lack of corroboration. It could be a hoax if one could not prove its authenticity. But no one has been able to prove or disprove the accuracy of the scenario, though its analytical assessment of the U.S. economy is sound. Hence, it is suspended in uncertainty, and we dare not take it off the table. If Al-Qaeda was the source, it would have been prepared somewhere in western Pakistan, placed on a computer memory stick, passed through several hands to disguise the source. And finally, an operative would have sent the message into the internet world from an internet cafe somewhere in the Middle East to a password-protected website. From there, it could have been sent to numerous destinations.